Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So the sutra today is the Mahavedala Sutra, the greatest series of questions and answers. And I have been going through the list of sutras which have been talked about, been dealt with, and this is one which hasn't been dealt with, and there's a good reason for that. It is because it's very complex sutta, it's a very deep, difficult to explain, and most monks would avoid it. But here we go. I'm going to, as they say, the fools jump in where angels fear to tread. So here we go. I'm going to attempt to give an explanation, a reading, an explanation of the Mahavedala Sutra. So there's one more person coming in. Please find a seat. And first of all, just a quick summary of the sutra. This sutra was a discourse between two of the very senior disciples of the Buddha, both arahats, Venerable Mahakotita and Venerable Sariputta. Even though they were both, only these two were mentioned in this sutra, it's most likely that Venerable Kotita came with some other monks to speak with Venerable Sariputta. So it's very likely that there were other monks in the audience listening to this discussion. And so Venerable Kotita, even though he probably knew the answers to his questions, he asked them for the benefit of the people surrounding him, the other sort of monks, maybe even lay people. And that was often a common practice in Buddhism, that even though that somebody would know the answer, they would ask the question of the speaker, usually the Buddha, for the sake and the benefit of those who are listening. So here we go. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove in the Anathapindika Park. Then when it was evening, the Venerable Mahakotita rose from meditation, went to the Venerable Sariputta and exchanged greetings with him. When his courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Venerable Sariputta, and the first question is about wisdom. One who is unwise. Now, first of all, that word is dupanyo. And I think the Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi is a very polite monk, but a more accurate rendering of that is stupid. It's a bit derogatory, and I think it's meant to be derogatory. So one who is stupid, it is said, friend. With reference to what is this said, one who is stupid? One who does not wisely understand. One does not wisely understand, friend. That is why it's said, one who is stupid. And what doesn't one wisely understand? One does not wisely understand this is suffering. One does not wisely understand this is the origin of suffering. One does not wisely understand this is the cessation of suffering. One does not wisely understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. One does not wisely understand what one does not wisely understand, friend. That is why it is said, one who is stupid. Saying, good friend, the Venerable Mahakotita delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then he asked him a further question. One who is wise, it is said, friend. With reference to what is this said, one who is wise? One wisely understands, friend. That is why it is said, one who is wise. What does wisely understand? What does one wisely understand? One wisely understands this is suffering. One wisely understands this is the origin of suffering. One wisely understands this is the cessation of suffering. And one wisely understands this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. One wisely understands, friend. That is why it is said, one who is wise. That's a simple start to the sutta, and of course it's making the point that you may be wise in understanding quantum physics, or you may be wise in understanding sort of the nature of genetic science, you may understand many, many things, but the point is here, the one which is really important to understand, as far as Buddhism is concerned, is actually the Four Noble Truths, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering. If you understand those things, even if you may not have a university degree, even if you might not even have graduated from high school, still you're considered to be wise. And even if you have got three doctorates, one from Oxford, one from Yale, and one from Harvard, even so, you are still considered to be stupid if you don't understand the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths was the standard of wisdom. I would understand that is by saying that that is the most important thing which will solve the problem of existence. Any comments on that one? It's a simple one. Before we get into the deeper stuff. Okay, here's the deeper stuff. Now it is understanding the nature of consciousness. Consciousness, this is the word vijnana. Consciousness, it is said, friend, with reference to what is consciousness said? And it uses the Pali form, it cognizes. Vijnanam is the Pali word, and vijanati is the Pali word for it cognizes. It's just what the mind does. It cognizes, friend. That is why consciousness is said. And what does it cognize? It cognizes this is pleasant, it cognizes this is painful, it cognizes this is neither pleasant nor painful. It cognizes, friend. That is why consciousness is said. Now that might seem a bit sort of just obvious, but sometimes, especially in the modern world, and I think this is true in the ancient world as well, consciousness, because it is identical with many people's idea of a self or a soul, that sometimes, yes, we might know a thing by what it is. But in Western philosophy, I remember being taught, it's much better to know a thing not by what it is, but what it does, what its function is. And by a thing's function, you can understand it much better. So consciousness, what actually is it? We can philosophize, we can have all sorts of theories and understandings of what consciousness is. But the best way to pin it down is to say, what does it do? And this is the answer here, that consciousness, what it does, we know it by its function, that it knows. And especially it knows that aspect of any experience which is pleasant, painful, or somewhere in between. That's what consciousness does. In a sense, that's what consciousness is. It is that which knows painful, pleasant, or unpleasant, or in between. So, I'm going to ask you the question now. If there is no cognizance of pleasure, there's no cognizance of pain, there's no cognizance of anything in between, does consciousness exist? No, of course not. There is no consciousness. So we know it by its function. When the function is not manifest, then consciousness is not manifest. It's just not there. So can we have a consciousness which doesn't experience pain, pleasure, or in between? We can't. Now I mention that because there is in all philosophies, even in all the history of Buddhism, there has always been an attempt to imagine a cosmic consciousness, a final consciousness, where after enlightenment you can live happily ever after without any suffering. And of course, if you really understand what they're saying here, defining consciousness, what is this consciousness? Can you have a consciousness which doesn't know anything? And it's saying here, you can't. If it's conscious, it cognizes. It knows something. That's its definition. So a consciousness which doesn't experience anything doesn't exist. And so if it experiences something, then we also have the problem. If it experiences pleasure and pain and in between, it's not really the end of the road. It's just another form of existence, of suffering. So anyway, we go for any comments on that? Yes. Yeah. Oh no, that's That's every sense, in the same way we see pleasant feelings, or so we see pleasant sights, or we hear painful sounds, or sort of, you know, the lunch today, darling, was beautiful. Beautiful really is supposed to be confined to what you see. Things are beautiful, but can sort of your lunch be beautiful? Really, you shouldn't use the word beautiful, but we just, in English, this is many language, we're sloppy. And so we can even have a beautiful smell. What we really should be saying, a fragrant smell. So anything pleasurable in any of the six senses is what's meant here. Oh, it's painful, it's ugly, it's detestable, it's whatever is unpleasant, that's what painful means. So this is with any of the six senses. Yes. The idea of cosmic consciousness, is it a theistic? It is usually a very refined theistic, a part of the theistic religions, but it's undefined. So what is that consciousness? What is that cosmic consciousness? And the point here is, instead of trying to understand it by what it is, it's much easier to see the fallacy of the argument of a cosmic consciousness by asking what it does, what it does, what it does. And here the answer is that all consciousness, it cognizes something, it knows something. So you can't have a cosmic consciousness which doesn't know something. Because the idea of a cosmic consciousness in the way people mean, it's like an ultimate consciousness where you can live happily ever after. Just a more refined form of the idea of a theistic heaven. Yes, well, you had a... Yeah, evolution. Well, the word evolution is usually used in the West. Refers to the evolution of a species, in other words, of the body. But it's also interesting to apply that concept of evolution to the evolution of a mind. And consciousness is fine, but that evolution of consciousness from life to life. So the idea of understanding an evolution of a mind or a consciousness apart from the body, that presupposes the existence of reincarnation or rebirth. And because many people don't accept that idea, it means they don't even have a concept of the evolution of the mind. Whereas in Buddhism, the evolution of mind is fundamental. Where a person's mind grows in wisdom, in the same way that the survival of the fittest principle means your body evolves to be more strong and be able to resist the pressures of the environment and survive and procreate. So the evolution of the body, we all accept that, but the evolution of a mind is something which is yet to be accepted by people. But it's very part and parcel of Buddhism. Why is it more violent today than centuries ago? I think that it's not more violent than it was centuries ago. If you look at some of the descriptions of the wars which happen between nations, there may not be as many people die, but the percentage of people dying was huge. There was huge amounts of violence. Nations laying waste to nations. So there was great violence then. There was great violence. I don't think people have changed. Yeah, indeed. I think that's what somebody asked Mahatma Gandhi once, what he thought about Western civilization. And he said it's a very good idea, if it would happen. Yes, because he saw it sort of as a myth. Yes.
I was just thinking, when you're on the ground, let's say in hospital, yeah.
That's right, yes. You're not cognizing anything. Therefore, consciousness has stopped. You're not cognizing. Although sometimes, you know, what happens in anesthesia, some people, they get to that middle state. They can cognize, but they can't react. Sitting in here, there's horror stories of people who are being cut up and they feel every slice of the knife and they can't scream. It's one thing, but apparently the anesthesia has got much better. And I think the last article I read was that they got some gizmo, they can possibly see that there is some reaction going on in there. So they stopped. Yes, very good, yes. Because it happened to quite a few people. They were under anesthesia, but they're fully awake. And they couldn't tell people, look, I'm still feeling this. So they were very much conscious, just like people in coma. Yeah, go on. Near-death experience, they're conscious. They're feeling pressure a long time, some disappointment. So now we have wisdom and consciousness. Are these states conjoined or disjoined? And is it possible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them? It's a very sort of strange question, wisdom and mind. Wisdom and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it is impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. For what one understands, they got so wisely understand, but that's not really in them. It says what one truly understands rather than wisely. In other words, your understanding is clear. What one understands, that one cognizes. And what one cognizes, that one understands. The word wisely, I think that is a misleading addition in that translation. And when one takes that away, I think it's much better. So instead of wisdom and consciousness, it's much better to call it understanding and consciousness. So understanding and consciousness. Friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined. It is impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. For what one understands, that one cognizes. And what one cognizes, that one understands. That's obvious because that takes away the problem with that statement. If it was, as it said, what one wisely understands, what one cognizes, that one wisely understands. Sometimes people cognize something, but they don't wisely understand it at all. They get it the wrong way around. So what that really should be saying, understanding and consciousness. What one understands, that one cognizes. What one cognizes, that one understands. One might understand it wrongly, but this one, he got that understanding. That is why these states are conjoined, not disjoined. It is impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. So what is the difference, then, between understanding and consciousness? Are these states that are conjoined, not disjoined? The difference, then, between understanding and consciousness, these states that are conjoined, not disjoined, is this. Understanding is to be developed. Consciousness is to be understood. In other words, not defining it by what it is, as much what its purpose is, what its function is. So, again, this is a beautiful way of developing wisdom. Not, again, what is this, what is this, what is this? But what does it do? What does it do? What does it do? And so understanding and consciousness. One has to be consciousness to understand. What one understands, what one is conscious of. Now you may not fully wisely understand what I just said, but there is an understanding there of what I just said, and you are conscious of that understanding. And that understanding may not be full yet, which is why the understanding needs to be developed. And the consciousness, the process, that needs to be fully understood. Yeah. Yes, indeed. So one understanding is not fully developed yet. There is a measure of understanding. So, you know, you were, from your body language, you were a bit bewildered when I first spoke, but you understood a little bit, but not enough. And by asking a question, you actually followed the function of understanding. You developed it by asking a question, by contemplating it deeper. So understanding needs to be developed. So by asking questions, taking it deeper, getting more evidence, and consciousness, not to develop it, to be understood, find out exactly, you know, what it really is. Any questions on that? So again, when I first read that, I thought, that's a bit difficult, but when you looked at the Pali, take off wisdom, put understanding, and the whole thing becomes quite clear. The next one is feeling. This is Vedana. And again, this word Vedana is precisely what we said before. It is a quality of every sensory experience which is pleasurable, painful, or somewhere in between. And as I mentioned, that every sense in English usually has a different word to define what it, to describe what is pleasant, what is painful. And I already mentioned there that delicious is pleasurable taste. Stinky is painful smell. But every sense experience is either pleasurable, painful, in between. You like it, you don't like it, or it's, you know, in between somewhere. So this is what the word Vedana is. It's that aspect of consciousness where pleasure, pain are in between. So with reference to what is feeling said, and feeling again is understood by its function. It's that which feels, friend. That's why it is feeling, is to said. And what does it feel? It feels pleasure, it feels pain. It feels neither pain nor pleasure. It feels, friend. That is why feeling is said. And now perception. Perception, perception. It is said, friend, with reference to what is perception said? And again, by its function, it perceives. It perceives, friend. That is why perception is said. What does it perceive? It perceives blue, it perceives yellow, it perceives red, it perceives white. It perceives, friend. That is why perception is said. Now, of course, that is just an example. It perceives boy, it perceives girl, it perceives day, it perceives night. You know, it perceives hunger, it perceives all the other aspects of sensory experience. We pick out one aspect of everything which is there, because I can look at, say, Ainsley and can say, like, man. Or I can look at him and say, getting on a bit in years. You can actually take so many aspects of what you experience, and you choose one or two, and that is called your perception. And of course, there's many, 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 many sort of examples of experiments done with perception, which gives you an idea of what's going on or what that word really means. One of my favorites was an experiment which was done in Yale. I think it's been repeated many, many times. In fact, I remember being on an aircraft in Indonesia last March. And during these long flights, there was no in-flight movies, but, you know, the screen came out. It was Garuda, it was very sort of cheap airline. And they had these, like, in my day, it was called candid camera, just where they tried to trick people, members of the public, in doing very, very funny things. And some of them were hilarious. And so once I just passed by this and saw it, I had to watch afterwards, because I must admit, when it comes to humor, I always get sucked in. But it was, this particular example done in Yale, and it was not done as a joke, it was done as an experiment. The students would go and approach, you know, the bystander, the victim, and ask a simple question like the way to the chemistry labs. But before they could answer, two other students dressed as workmen carrying a big door would go between them. And so for a couple of seconds, the victim and the person questioning them, they would be out of sight of each other. But it was only for a couple of seconds. And then the the student would continue to ask the question, "No, I'm sorry about that. Where's the chemistry lab?" And the trick was that the first person who asked the question would go with the door and be replaced by a second person who would continue to ask the question. And it was trying to find out whether the victim would actually notice the questioner had changed. And they used all sorts of combinations, you know, from a big Caucasian football player, male, then to a sort of a little old lady, you know, sometimes a black old lady, and then a little Chinaman, and then a sort of a beautiful woman or whatever. And the point was that most of the people who were victims or asked the question never realized that the person had changed, because their perception had only noticed the question and noticed nothing about the questioner. That's what the perception was limited to, just the most important feature of that experience, which to them was just the question. They didn't care about who asked the question. So they could change the question, they could swap them around. Old, young, tall, fat, short, and people wouldn't notice. It was a very great experiment. And the reason was, when we use our perception, we only note a tiny fraction of the experience, what we think is important to us. And that's why perception can be quite deluding. But it sees it's blue, it sees it's yellow. Nothing is blue. You know, you see a person, they're not pink, or they're not black, they're not brown. They've got many, many different colours in them. But this is the way perception works. It just takes one feature and decides that describes the event. So perception, that's what perception is. Any questions on that? Yeah. Yes, our brain is, because our brain is very efficient. At least my brain is very lazy and only does things which it has to do. The same with perception. It's totally involuntary. You only perceive what your brain thinks is important. It filters all the rubbish. It's just like most of perception is spam. And that just gets deleted. And that which you think is important comes to the surface. It's every sense has perception. If you want to perceive, say, the body, then closing your eyes and being in silence gives your brain more space to perceive the sensations in the body. But even then, it'll only see the perceptions which are important. For example, now can you perceive the feeling in your mouth with your saliva? That's always been there, but you don't usually pay attention to it because it's not important. So much of our perceptions is very efficient. It just, that which isn't important, just forget about it. And that which really is important, that's which what we see, that's what we hear. I think that my perception of him is daggers in his eyes. Yes, that's only the most important word you said there, and which Ainsley should also pick up, was only sometimes. Only when you deserve it. Yeah.
You talked about brain just now.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, very good, yes. I use the brain because most people understand the brain has only got a certain capacity, and that's why it makes sense that sort of the perceptual activity of the brain is very, very efficient, so it doesn't keep perceiving things which it doesn't need to perceive. Yes, even brain-wise, it just doesn't, lights don't turn on. But when it comes to the mind, the mind also has only a certain capacity. So again, the mind will only be attend to those things which it thinks are really important. And those things which it thinks are unimportant, it will not cognize. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. That's why you said the perception. You come into a room and what do you actually see? You just see what you want to see, or rather what you need to see. Those two sort of intermingle. And it's true, that's all that happens. You see what you need to see, you see what you want to see. Everything else, you don't perceive at all. So, very often that you may go, someone may come into your house and they say, oh, have you seen my new curtains? And it's not really important, to me if I visit your house. So I'll say, no, I haven't seen them. Even though my eyes have seen them, it just hasn't registered. Or just like sort of, Barbara, if you have a new head and you wait for your husband to notice your head. And they say, you haven't noticed my hairdo. I said, oh, the answer is, I say, oh, just because your smile just is all I ever see in life, because that's such a beautiful thing. Use something else, because the perception of the beautiful apart from the hairdo, then you get out of trouble. You can. I think you're asking the question, can you train your perception just to see things which are really important? I think probably you can. I mean, it's a person who is, say a footballer. They would perceive sort of things on a football field which I would never be able to perceive, because they've trained themselves and that's their skill, that's their game. Yeah, visually, yes. Obviously like a conductor or a musician. They can perceive changes in tone or timbre of the instruments, which I will never know. So, perception actually can be trained. As a meditator, as you know, my perception of my mind is very acute. So that's why you can get into these deep states of meditation. You can perceive the mind and know exactly what the problems are, what the benefits are, or what the sort of the joys are. You can actually move your way in there, because that's my field. Conditioning, cause and effect, training, developing. But this is just understanding what perception is. Yeah. And how it works. But I must admit that the modern psychology has some great experiments which reveal just how perception works. And also how assumptions. We assume we know and we see the world through those assumptions. The other experiment, which I thought was very fascinating, they took a class, this was done in Harvard, and into a dark room, and they flashed on the screen an image. But it was far too short an exposure to see what was really on there. But they still had to guess what they thought it was. And then the exposure was increased incrementally. And one of the examples I remember, the photo, the image, was of a well-known part of campus. It was some famous stairs to the Senate or something. But then one of the students said, oh, it was a ship at sea. And once they had that idea, they continued to persist with the perception it was a ship, even when the exposure was so long that an ordinary person coming into that room for the first time would have recognized that's a flight of stairs. And it just shows that once we think we know, that knowledge influences our perception, bends it to fit our knowledge. And when I heard that, oh wow, that's interesting, but that's also very dangerous. Our perception is not free. But eventually, that when the image was exposed long enough, they realize, oh, it's not the ship at sea, it's those old stairs. But the first impression which came in was so important, it took a long exposure to show them what the reality was. So perception is bent, especially by our views. So there's heaps of very fascinating psychology work done on perception, and it's very revealing. And very Buddhist. So paragraph 9, again, is also important. This feeling, perception and consciousness, friend, are these states conjoined or disjoined? And is it possible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them? Feeling, perception and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it is impossible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them. For what one feels, that one perceives, and what one perceives, that one cognizes. That is why these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it is impossible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them. So, these things are just different aspects of one sensory experience. In the same way that you can have, say, a flower, and you can actually, it's got petals, it's got fragrance, it's got form. You know, you can't actually take the fragrance apart from the flower. You can't take its colour, you know, as if you can somehow separate that out. It's just part of just one experience. So three different aspects of one and the same experience. And this is also an important part of Buddhism. If you have consciousness, you have to have perception, you have to have feeling. They all come together. You can't have one without the other two. If you have a feeling, you know, pleasure, pain or in between, you have to have consciousness, you have to have perception. You can't have just one without the other. And you know, if you have perception, you have to have consciousness, you have to have perception, which is either pleasurable, painful, or in between. You can't have it without that. So these are essential parts of experience, which is why you can't split them up. If it's conscious, you're perceiving, you're feeling. And even this feeling, pleasure, pain, or in between, it's a lot of perception. It's almost like a part of perception. You're perceiving that particular aspect of the experience, which is pleasurable, painful, or in between. And even what you take as pleasurable, or what you take as painful. Now sometimes you've added that from your perceptions, what you expected. A lot of pleasure or pain is also conditioned. So in other words, if I say cook a meal, oh no, let's do it, something more interesting. If I make some holy water for you, and I sprinkle you with holy water, say, oh, I feel so good now, I feel so wonderful. Is it really what you're feeling? Or is it just, you know, your perception has bent the experience to actually to feel what you want to feel, what you expect to feel, rather than what's really there? Does holy water really work? Or is it because you want it to work? Oh yes, some distortions do help towards clarity. So, you know, as long as you're distorted in the right direction, which ends distortions. Because the thing is, it'll always be distorted, there'll always be some bending there. So, faith is a good example. Faith distorts your perception and feeling. But as long as it's faith in the right things, then it's okay. If it's faith in the wrong things, you're in trouble. That's why faith is very dangerous. But it can be helpful if you're lucky. Indeed. The placebo effect is also very important, yeah. So if you think it's going to work, it does work. So you perceive it's working and you feel it's working. The pain is disappearing. That's a very clear feeling. But anyway, the main point of this is actually, well, you've actually brought up the delusory part of feeling and perception. But the main point of this is understanding what perception is, understanding what feeling is, understanding what consciousness is, and understanding they all go together. You can't split one off from the other. Every moment of consciousness, you'll be perceiving something and feeling something. Every time you perceive, you'll be conscious, you'll be feeling something. Every time you feel, you're perceiving and conscious. And understanding feeling is that aspect of pleasure, pain. When it's conscious, there's pleasure, there's pain in between. So you can't have consciousness without enjoying it, disliking it, or somewhere neutral in between. Okay. So, bottom of paragraph 9, feeling, perception, consciousness, when these states are conjoined, not disjoined, is it possible? That is why these states are conjoined, not disjoined. It is impossible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them. Now we have knowable by mind alone. That's a very interesting sort of paragraph heading here. Now this paragraph heading is not in the sutta. This was added by Bhikkhu Bodhi. So I have got three question marks above that, so just forget about knowing knowable by mind alone. Instead, the first sentence is, friend, what can be known by mind consciousness that is purified, released from the five faculties? The five faculties mean the five senses, the Panchindriya. So what can be known by the mind consciousness purified from the five senses? And here it says, friend, by purified mind consciousness, or for mind consciousness purified from the five senses, instead of the faculties, this is better English, the base of infinite space can be known. Space is infinite. The base of infinite consciousness can be known. Consciousness is infinite. The base of nothingness can be known. There is nothing. That's actually the three arupa states. The arupa states, these are the immaterial attainments. So this is when the mind has been purified. In other words, really so apart from the five senses. So the ordinary jhanas, they are apart from the five senses, but not totally purified, and since not far enough away from them. So these are the three immaterial attainments. Why do you think that the fourth immaterial attainment of neither perception or non-perception is missing? And the reason is because it's one of those states that really, can you know it, can you not know it? It's neither perception or non-perception. So it's in this in-between state, which is a lot of time they say it's just far too ephemeral for a person to really know it. It's there, but it's just so hard to fully know. That's why it's missing. Any question there? Yeah? The emptiness, please ask that question a bit later, because the idea of emptiness comes up soon with sunyata, with the deliverance of mind. As many people say, and this is reasonably good description, that these arupa states are almost like special cases of the fourth jhana. They are almost like fourth jhana, but in just more and more refined modes. So I would say yes, fourth jhana is the same there. It's you're away from the five senses totally, a long way away. Not for that, you're still away from the five senses. But the first jhana in particular, in another sutta the Buddha says that the thorn, what can actually penetrate that first jhana is sound. So the sound is not there in the jhana, but you are vulnerable to sound. So you're away, but not far away enough. It's like, you know, you may be sort of outside your house, but not far enough away for your wife to be able to call you and ask you to come back to help with the kids. If you're right down the road, you know, maybe the next suburb is too far away. And next we have here, with what does one understand a state that can be known? A state which can be known. I followed another translation there. Friend, with what can understand an inferred state, an inference? It's a nyaya dhamma. Something actually, a nyaya dhamma, a dhamma which comes from leading on. So this is the inferences. So not what you experience, but understanding what does this infer? What does this, for example? Those examples of like perception sometimes being wrong. Those experiences, what does that infer? What does that mean? So with what can one understand inferences? And they say, friend, one understands an inference with the eye of wisdom. And they use this, like the idea of an eye. And they use that not just the eye of seeing, but the eye of wisdom, apanya chakku. And the eye of wisdom. So this is that particular type of wisdom which can know inferences. You understand the word inference? Okay. Okay, your husband comes back with lipstick on his collar very late at night with a big smile on his face. You're going to infer something from that. You know, he's been playing around with the mistress. You don't know that. You know, all he's got is a lipstick on his collar. His friends may have put that on there for a joke. He may be late because, you know, he's had to work late. He may have a big smile on his face because he's happy to see you. But, you know, we infer by adding one and one and up, we get three or four or five. So it's the inference. Oh, yeah. Oh, that one, yeah. It's not separating them, because each one of these states is a form, you're conscious of these states, and there's a feeling there which is very pleasurable, and you're perceiving a certain aspect of this experience. So what you perceive?
It's just the title.
The title, yeah. Yeah. So, for example, there is nothing. That's what you perceive. And that, so okay, you get into very refined states, so you perceive there's nothing there. And that's the object of your consciousness, absolutely emptiness, sunyata, empty, gone, nothing left. That's yes, but you're conscious of that, you perceive that, and you, there's a feeling there, beautiful, peaceful feeling. Okay, the eye of wisdom. But first of all, do you understand that one, sort of? Okay, yeah. I do really hate saying that you've got to experience it to understand it, because for many times that's a cop-out in philosophy and religion, you know, just saying that I know better than you. But I think you should be able to get your head around it a little way. Remember that this is... Sometimes for those arupa states, I've had pretty good success in using a simile of something which, you know, you've all experienced, I hope, with your meditation, present moment awareness. And I use that present moment awareness, you know, in the now. In the now, what are you perceiving? You know, it's no past, no future, there's no time. So there's no time there, but, you know, there is still the perception of there is no time. So there's a sense of nothingness there, of emptiness, something which you're very used to, you know, past, future, and the passage of time. That is gone. In the sense that you know it's gone. There's a perception there. So when things disappear, there's nothing there, but there's a perception that's disappeared. There is nothing. It's your perception, but you know it's disappeared. Any better? Getting closer? Okay. I think if you really want to get similes. Get similes from the early stages of meditation, like even silence. No sound. This is nothing. Anyway, let's see how further we can go here. With the, okay, with your question, Cheng, which was the, what was it about? Eye of wisdom, yes. So what is your question, the eye of wisdom? Inference, yes. Again, inference is inference. You're inferring something. So it's just like in any sort of logic reason. You know, you make inferences. You see where this leads or what it must mean, where it comes from. So you've got your evidence and you want to find out just what this means.
Oh.
I think this is a different question. So even though it's under the same paragraph, it's a totally different sort of, it's going off on another tangent. So, friend, with what does one understand a state that can be known or can be inferred? You infer with the eye of wisdom. And what is the, and there's another sort of completely sort of different question here, which not necessarily is a consequence of the question preceding it. What is the purpose of this wisdom? And the purpose, the function of wisdom, in the sense, not just what it does, but what it should be doing, what its end point is. The purpose of wisdom, friend, is direct knowledge. Its purpose is full understanding. Its purpose is abandoning. So, this wisdom, from the eye of wisdom, why do you have an eye? What are you trying to infer? What's the purpose of all this? It's actually directly understanding. In other words, fully understanding for yourself, direct understanding as opposed to belief, as opposed to taking on trust, as opposed to assumptions. In other words, in your face knowledge, direct knowledge. Yeah, experience, but clear, direct experience for yourself, rather than taking it on other people's say-so, or on what's said in the texts. So for direct knowledge, its purpose is a full understanding, and the full understanding is a great word. It means understanding all around, not just 99% understanding, but the full understanding of it. And the good example of that is the understanding of dukkha, suffering. The Buddha said that what you have to do is to fully understand that. Because people don't fully understand it, they're only 99% or 99.9%, that's why they're not streaming this yet. But fully, complete understanding it thoroughly, not missing any part of it, then that's the full understanding. In the same way that the two nibbanas, the nibbana of an arahat, when you get enlightened, and a pari-nibbana, when you leave, one is nibbana, one is sava, full nibbana, this word pari, which means, the prefix means totally full all around. So when the arahat dies, full cessation, absolutely gone, nothing left at all. Full knowledge, total knowledge of this particular area of suffering, nothing you don't really understand about it. You've seen it to its depth. Yeah. Exactly, that's a very good understanding. The more the wisdom, the more understanding is the lack of ownership. So it's not me, it's not mine or the self. And so the abandoning is a consequence, a purpose, its end point. So wisdom is not, its purpose is not gaining more things like attainments and status. It's a way of abandoning everything, letting things go. Disappearing, vanishing. Emptiness. So, your word emptiness earlier is an important word. If it's empty, there's nothing there, nothing left. You've abandoned things, you've got rid of things. The eye of wisdom is just a faculty which, will produce stream winning, will produce arahat, will produce, your understanding, deep understanding of anything in life. It's a faculty which they gave a name to in Buddhism, the eye of wisdom, which actually can actually understand inferences and see where they lead. So all the words which I said, you infer from that, you understand. And if you really truly understand what was said here, you've been developing the eye of wisdom. It's just not knowing, it's actually really comprehending deeply. Of course it does, yeah. It takes, yeah. Correct, yes. So even the arupa states and everything else there, first of all you understand it, but to fully understand it, it takes a while. That's right, it's just like, you know, you come and listen to the talks, it takes a while, you understand it, but it takes a while to fully understand it. Every time it's repeated, you understand it a bit deeper, a bit more. And so full understanding is how which is developed. And you use this dhammacakku. If you've got a very sharp dhammacakku, in other words, this eye of wisdom, panyachakku, this eye of wisdom. If you have a very strong eye of wisdom, then it's very fast. Yeah. Oh, the fourth arupa you talk about. The fourth arupa is again too subtle. That sometimes that many people, including the monks here, say it's a bit too subtle. So do the one before. So I better hurry on here because I've already done 3 pages and there's a lot of pages to go to be here all night, and so will you. Okay. So, right view. Here we go. This is one of my favourite ones. So this is a powerful one as well, so don't mind if I spend time on this. Right view, this is Samadhiti. And Samadhiti, right view, is the one which is perfected at the attainment of stream winning. The first factor of the Eightfold Path. That's why a stream winner is sometimes called Dittipato, one attained to view. Right view, you've actually seen it. So this is an important, how many conditions are there for the arising of right view? How does right view come about? Friends, there are 2 conditions for the arising of right view. Not the voice of another, that was a yucky translation. The words of another. The words of another. And wise attention. These are the 2 conditions for the arising of right view. The voice, the words of another, that in other suttas, because we look what's here and we compare it to what's in other suttas. It's not any other person, it's another Aryan. Another person who's at least a stream winner, once returned, non-returned, or arahat, like a Buddha. That's actually explained in the commentaries, and that's actually a very decent translation because that fits with other sayings in the other suttas. So this is the words, the teachings of another person who's at least a stream winner. And as the commentary says, if you haven't got a stream winner, a once returned, non returned arahat around, these are the words of an Aryan, the suttas. So listening to the suttas, the words of a Buddha, or in this particular case, the words of Sariputra and Mahakotita, the words of arahats. Or if you are lucky enough, a monk or a nun in your community who's got some attainments. They're powerful. And without those, you can't get stream winning. You can't get right view. And I think you understand why. Because sometimes people take you down all sorts of side streets and all sorts of weird explanations which will stop you seeing the truth. You need someone who knows what they're talking about. Yeah. Okay. That's like the words of an Aryan, as in the sutras, the teachings of a Buddha. Does that need to be explained? It helps having an explanation, but there's one thing which you will see by reading even just this one group of suttas. There's a certain consistency there, a message which keeps being reinforced again and again and again and again. And so just the extent and the power and the clarity of these suttas is so strong that you really need to be very deluded not to sort of pick it up what the Buddha's saying. So these are, I would say, powerful enough without needing to have it being interpreted. Interpretations help if you're getting a good interpreter. But these stand on by themselves. But again, one thing which Venerable Jnanaponika sort of taught me, I met him when he was still alive, and if you are relying on these suttas, these readings by yourself, he said, never interpret the whole of the Buddha's teachings on the basis of one or two obscure passages. Because you'll find in the suttas, there's some passages which monks even today, they argue, what does it mean, what does it mean? Because it's not so clear. It's mostly in the poetry, the verses. Because the verses are never meant to be definitive, they're supposed to get a mood, an emotion. An example, I wandered lonely as a cloud. That's Wordsworth. Now, of course, you can analyze that. It means, my goodness, he could levitate, he could fly through the air. Because that's what it said. But of course, it was never meant to say he was levitating up in the air to wander lonely as a cloud. It was meant to sort of evoke an emotion. And most poetry is meant to be evocative rather than definitive. But still these days, some people, they take a passage of poetry and they base the whole of their understanding of Buddhism just on one or two obscure passages. And Vedanyana Panika said, no, take the mass of very clear passages, Eightfold Path, you know, Four Noble Truths. Those are the things, you know, five khandhas, six sense bases, you know, dependent origination. Those are very, very clear. So get those in your head first of all, and then interpret the obscure passages in light of the mass, rather than interpret the mass of teachings in terms of a small number of obscure passages. Okay. So those are the two conditions. Oh, the other conditions, not just the words of another. Wise attention, that's yonisa manasikara. I've always given another spin to that, because yonisa manasikara literally means work of the mind which goes to the source, which goes in and in and in and in. And to me, that was the reference to the meditation. And that's why in my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, work of the mind which goes in. Wise attention is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of that term. It literally means work of the mind which goes inside, which goes to the source, which goes to the womb. That's what yoni means. It means a womb. So in other words, to really understand that, that's what I suggest. That means where the meditation comes in. And I've given that simile before in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond in many talks. To become a screen winner, you need the match and the gunpowder. The gunpowder is the words of another, the teachings, all that you've heard, all you've understood about Buddhism. But you can be a great professor, but still not become a screen winner. You need the match, the flame, the jhana. Ah, now I see it, now I know. So that's my interpretation of the words of another. So of the yonisa manasikara. Now, how many factors is right view assisted when it has deliverance of mind for its fruit, deliverance of mind for its fruit and benefit? When it has deliverance by wisdom for its fruit, deliverance by wisdom for its fruit and benefit. In other words, how many factors is right view assisted by if you want to become enlightened? And those right view is assisted by five factors. If you want to become enlightened, it is assisted by virtue, learning, discussion, serenity and insight. Right view, which has been, and I'm going to say here, I'm going to change this a little bit, right view which has been assisted by these factors has deliverance of mind for its fruit, deliverance of mind for its fruit and benefit, deliverance by wisdom for its fruit, deliverance by wisdom as its fruit and benefit. So I remember having a discussion with Bhikkhu Bodhi about this. From my understanding here, and there's a strong argument, that these five benefits are what supports the arising of right view. And that particular right view which has enlightenment as its goal, in other words, the right view of streamlining. And this is another important thing if you want to be a streamliner. Those five things are virtue. Now your precepts, and not just precepts, your general goodness, that is a strong assisting factor for the attainment of streamlining. Learning and discussion. It's not just reading, it's not just sort of knowledge, it's holding that knowledge by discussing it. if you haven't got another teacher, no more like questioning, cross-referencing, that might do the same. But if you have got a teacher, not just listening, but questioning as well. He said those two are very important. Not just soaking it in, but asking questions afterwards. Discussion. Learning and discussion. That's why Buddhism has always encouraged people to question, to argue. And the last two, surprise, surprise, Samatha Vipassana. These are the five things which support the arising of right view. Virtue, learning, discussion. It's actually hearing Dhamma and discussing Dhamma, learning, discussion. Hearing Dhamma, discussing Dhamma. Samatha, serenity, vipassana. Right view that has been assisted by these factors has deliverance of mind for its fruit, deliverance of mind for its fruit and benefit. Has deliverance by wisdom for its fruit, deliverance by wisdom for its fruit and benefit. Yeah? Is it things you do, things that give you more peace and well-being? That's the consequence of virtue. It takes away the worry, it takes away the guilt, it gives you more self-esteem when you realise you're a really good person and a wonderful person in this world. So it does uplift you, it energises you, it motivates you. It takes away the negativity of depression and ill will towards yourself. But the virtue is also gives you another energy of the mind. And as I mentioned that, if you get your meditation to nimitta stage, that's where you really can see directly the result of your virtue. If you've really had lived a virtuous life, a pure life, and it's not just keeping five precepts, it's just being a really good, kind, helpful person, then your nimitta is incredibly pure and brilliant, and you've got power in your mind. So when you have a lack of virtue, you may say this is experiential, you're just taking away your energy, your power. You're becoming dull. You haven't got the mental oomph to see deeply. It may be why that I remember in universities and colleges a long time ago, they insisted that professors had a very strong sense of virtue, much higher than general society. Not because they were educators of others, but maybe it's because that's what they needed, that self-discipline, to be able to find profound truths, whether it's in science or any other discipline. They were called disciplines. Okay, let's...
Do we just go by your way of saying that, of understanding the whole thing, that we just need to work when, what you need to do when you want to be enlightened, instead of all this deliverance of mind, food,
and... Oh, that's right, yeah. The long phases, yes, they mean, there's no doubt about that. No one argues, so that means if you want to have full enlightenment. It's because in Buddhism, rather in Pali, if you could use six words rather than one, you always use six. And you find that all the time in reading this. And it's just to make it absolutely sure. So that people... You know, you're a girl, you're a woman, you're a female. That's just to make absolutely sure that you know I'm describing you. Now, in English, you just say you're female. You don't have to say you're a girl, you're a woman, you're female. What's that adding to it? But in Pali, always put as much extra as you possibly can so there can be no doubt. Okay, that's actually not here. Have a few explanations on deliverance. Deliverance by mind, deliverance by wisdom. It is a technical term. Deliverance of mind means that you are enlightened with the experience, at least of one of the arupa jhanas. The deliverance of wisdom without the deliverance of mind. Everybody is deliverance of mind, deliverance of wisdom. It's if you've got it both ways, they call it ubato bhyanjana vimuti. That's when you have the arupas. So it means the two types of deliverances, you've got deliverance with the arupas or enlightenment with the arupa, or one of them at least, and enlightenment without the arupa. Those are the two differences. I better get going here. It's a very good sutta. Being. Being or existence, I prefer the word existence rather than being. Friend, how many kinds of existence are there? There are three kinds of existence: sensory existence, fine material existence, and immaterial existence. The sensory, these are the realms of existence. So this is actually where a person can live and be reborn. The sensory existence is where you have things like five senses. It includes the hell realms, the ghost realms, the animal realms, the human realms, the deva realms, up to the Brahma realm. That is called the sensory existence, where you can see, hear, smell, taste and touch, or at least you have similar senses to that. And above that is the what you call the fine material existence, and those are the ones which are based on the jhanas. So first, second, third, fourth jhana realms. Beings who, because they've attained jhana before, or they at the time of death, they get into that jhana, they go into that light at the end of the tunnel, and they know what to do with that to get into a jhana, then their rebirth is actually as in the jhana realms. Blissed out, but for such a long time. And the immaterial existence is based on the arupa attainments. Now, paragraph 16. Friend, how is renewal of being in the future generated? And I would like to just say that in English. How is rebirth or reincarnation in the future generated? Because the word for reincarnation or rebirth is pulabhava, more existence. How is renewal of existence in the future generated? How do you get reincarnated? Friend, reincarnation in the future is generated through the delighting in this and that on the part of beings who are hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Delighting in this and delighting in that. Delighting in the football, delighting in your children, delighting in going overseas and seeing the Great Wall of China, delighting in having a nice meal this evening. So that delight creates a craving, which creates the rebirth. Friends, how is reincarnation in the future not generated? With a fading away of delusion, with the arising of true knowledge, that's vicha, and with the cessation of craving, the renewal or reincarnation in the future is not generated. It's a tough ask, and so how do you do that? How do you fade away ignorance, or how do you arise true knowledge, and how do you stop craving? Answer is? Oh, that's only 1/8 of it. The Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path. Now, we've got the first jhana. We don't have the second, third, or fourth jhana here, because the first jhana is just understanding that one. It's implied you can understand some of the rest. What is the first jhana? Here, friend, and I'm going to do my translation as you heard before, quite secluded from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome states, that's the five hindrances. A monk abide enters, or monk, nun, layperson, enters upon the abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, with the rapture and pleasure born of the seclusion from the five senses. This is called the first jhana. How many factors does the first jhana have? Friend, the first jhana has five factors. Here, when a monk has entered upon the first jhana, there occur the movement of the mind onto the objects, the holding the objects, which is the rapture and pleasure, and the unification of the mind, in other words, that oneness of the mind feeling. That is how the first jhana has five factors. And friend, how many factors are abandoned in the first jhana and how many factors are possessed? In the first jhana, five factors are abandoned and five factors are possessed. Here, when a monk or nun, layperson, has attended upon the first jhana, sensory desire is abandoned. That's the first hindrance. Ill will is abandoned, sloth and torpor abandoned, restlessness and remorse are abandoned, and doubt is abandoned. So that's the five hindrances of abandoned. That's one of the definitions of the first jhana. And the five factors come in, which is movement of the mind onto the object, holding onto that object of bliss, the rapture and pleasure which forms the bliss, and the unification of the mind. That is how in the first jhana five factors are abandoned and five factors are possessed. Now we're talking about the five faculties or the five senses. The five faculties here refer to sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. Friend, these five senses each have a separate field, a separate domain. Now do not experience each other's field and domain. That is the eye faculty, the ear, the nose, the tongue and the body faculty. Now these five faculties, each having a separate field, a separate domain, not experiencing each other's field and domain, what is their resort? The resort is where do they go to, where do they end up? What experiences their fields and domains? Friend, these five senses each have a separate field, a separate domain, and do not experience each other's field or domain. That is eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. Now these five faculties each have a separate field, a separate domain, not experience each other's field or domain, have mind. That sixth sense is that resort. That's where they end up. And mind experiences their fields and domains. Friend, as these five senses, what are these five senses stand in dependence on? Friend, as these five senses stand in dependence on vitality. Basically, I would call this like life. It's, the word is are you. And very often that word almost also means, I think Sinhalese, are you Bhuwan? May you have a long life. It means, are you, is this idea of vitality, life. So it's a word which we don't really have an English equivalent to. Life force is probably the best. But here we go into a bit of difficulty here, because what does vitality stand depends upon? In my edition here, which is an old edition, I have a repeated paragraph. They say that life force stands in dependence on heat, this uzma. Because they have this idea in ancient Indian, especially in Buddhist times, like the heat of the body, the heat of the mind, it's like energy. But they call it heat. So let's call it life heat. Life force depends upon life heat. What does life heat stand in dependence upon? It stands in dependence upon life vitality. So it's gone around in the circle here. Just now, friend, we understood the Venerable Sariputta to have said, life force is dependent on life heat. And now we understood him to say, life heat stands in dependence upon life force. How should the meaning of these statements be regarded? In this case, friend, I shall give you a simile, for some wise men and women here understand the meaning of a statement by means of a simile. Just as when an oil lamp is burning, its radiance is seen in dependence on its flame, and its flame is seen in dependence on its radiance. So too, by life force stands in dependence on life heat, and life heat stands in dependence upon life force. So basically two aspects of existing. Now that is important for what comes next, which is an interesting part of Buddhism, if any of you ever get into the very, very deep meditation. Friends, are life force, vital formations, states of feeling, or are vital formations one thing and states of feeling another? The vital formations are Ayu Sankara. And it's just very difficult to understand an English word or get an English word for that. Vital formations or life force formations. Vital formations, friends, are not states of feeling. If vital formations were states of feeling, then when a monk or nun meditator has entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling, that's just beyond the last arupa state, they would not be seen to emerge from it. But because this life force formations are one thing and states of feeling another, when a monk, nun, lay meditator has entered upon the cessation of perception of feeling, they can be seen to emerge from it. Now this is the answer to a question which sometimes people have asked me. They said, well, when you get into this state, just beyond the fourth arupa state, which is the fourth arupa is neither perception or non-perception, and already people have mentioned that's a bit weird to get your head around, neither perception or non-perception, but after that, cessation of all feeling and perception. That's when the mind stops, consciousness finished. But why do you come out from that state? Why can't you just disappear from there? And this is the answer here. This thing called vital formations hasn't ceased yet. It is that, Vayu Sankara, the life force, if you like, is not finished. Friend, when this body is bereft of how many things, is it then discarded and forsaken, left lying like a senseless log? And that's basically when it's dead. Friend, when this body is bereft of three things, the vitality, heat, and consciousness. What do you mention the vitality and heat? The life force, the life heat, and consciousness. It is then discarded and forsaken, left lying, senseless like a log. So what is the difference between one who is dead, completed his time, and a monk who has entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling? So how do you know a person who is in this deep state, sort of cessation of perception and feeling, no conscious finish, and being dead? What's the difference? Friend, in the case of one who is dead, who has completed his time, his bodily formations have ceased and subsided, his verbal formations have ceased and subsided, his mental formations have ceased and subsided, his vitality, his life force is exhausted, his life heat has been dissipated, and his faculties are fully broken up. In the case of a bhikkhu who has entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling, his body formations have ceased and subsided, his verbal formations have ceased and subsided, his mental formations have ceased and subsided. So no consciousness, no sort of perception or feeling, that's all gone. But his life force, his vitality is not exhausted, his life heat has not been dissipated, and his faculties become exceptionally clear. Faculties becoming exceptionally clear, that means when he emerges afterwards, it's just being clean. The interesting thing here, his life heat has not been dissipated. And that's always where we find the difference. If a person is in deep meditation, if they're cold, they're dead. If there's still warmth there, they're still in deep meditation. That happened a long time ago. That person I mentioned in my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, I haven't seen him for a while now, I don't know what's happened to him, but who got into that deep jhana was taken to the Charles Gardner Hospital. He was in a deep jhana because he wasn't breathing, there was no mental activity, no brain activity when they put the EEG on him or the ECG. It's a great story. One of the reasons he told me why the doctor did not send him to the morgue was not just that his wife had told him he'd been meditating, and the doctor was an Indian, so he thought he was in some deep state of meditation. That was a possibility which he had heard of, but also his body was warm. And that warmth, that heat, actually was one of the reasons why that doctor now carried on putting defibrillators on his body. And when I heard that, I thought, well, that's amazing, because that's exactly how you would know a person's in deep meditation, not dead. See if they're still hot. So if ever you see me, Venerable Dharakata, in my cave, and I haven't come out for a few days, and I'm just sitting there, please, you know, don't feel my pulse, because it won't be there. So just feel the heat, see if there's any heat left. And if I'm still warm, leave me there. Please don't take me to Bowen O'Day or Chippers or any other funeral. Please don't cremate me.
Just put a plate of fish and chips.
No, that won't get me up. So that's a fascinating thing there. This is the difference between one who is dead or who has completed his time and a monk or a nun, a layperson, who's entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling. That's powerful. I better keep... Cheng, is it really important? Because I'm going to have to... Yeah?
Talking about three kinds of
feelings,
how come we talk about
vital formation?
It doesn't apply to
beings in the air. It does apply to them. It applies to all existence. So the life force still keeps going. That's one of the reasons why they come out of the jhanas. Yeah, they come out again. They've still got life force. Okay, now we've got the deliverance of mind. How many conditions are there for the attainment of the neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind? Now you can see this is not nibbana. Neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. That is a fourth jhana. Friend, there are four conditions for the attainment of the neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. Deliverance of mind from what? Five senses, from many other things. Here, with the abandoning of pleasure, with the abandoning of pain, that means physical pleasure, physical pain, of the five sense world. With the previous disappearance of joy and the previous disappearance of grief, they're the two mental, pleasure or pain. So with all of the happiness and unhappiness of all the six senses gone, those are the four things which have gone. The meditator enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. These are the four conditions attained with neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. Okay, now, one thing always with these jhanas, purity of mindfulness. I always like to emphasize that, because some people think these are a trance, you don't know really what's going on. It's saying here very clearly, mindfulness is absolutely pure here. You're aware. How many conditions are there for the attainments of the signless deliverance of mind? Now we go into stuff which is nibbana, which is the attainment of enlightenment. Because the signless deliverance of mind is one of the descriptions of enlightenment. Friend, there are two conditions for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind. Non-attention to all signs and attention to the signless element. These are the two conditions for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind. What is that signless deliverance of mind? The nearest I can explain it to you was, actually it's more, now, can I go on for a little bit? When you get to the mid, say there's a bit of confusion here, because a lot of times I call this a measureless deliverance of mind. And this comes from that statement from Lord Kelvin that the only way to control nature is learn how to measure her accurately first. It was a statement by a great scientist, philosopher, who was responsible for much of what we call the Industrial Revolution in UK and other countries. And when someone mentioned that to me, turned it around, to control nature you've got to measure her. When you stop measuring things, you can't control. Which is one of the reasons I've taught that in meditation retreats. Stop measuring good meditation, bad meditation, long, short. When you stop all measuring, then there's no way of controlling. You let things be, you let things go. And that means you become very still and very peaceful. That is an indication of what the signless deliverance is. There's no being peaceful, there's no being agitated. All of those concepts, you're totally eradicated, totally signless. A signless is where they can give you directions. Go this way, go that way. Imagine a place with absolutely no signs, there's nowhere to go. You sit still, you disappear. And the other part of that is recognizing that the word in Pali for measuring is manati. And the word for mind is mano. Literally, it means what the mind does. What the mind does is measures. It grabs onto signs. And he said, when you stop grabbing onto signs, when you stop measuring, your mind vanishes. It's got nothing to do anymore. Its function disappears. It stops. It becomes delivered. No, because a purity is a sign, is a measurement. So you get really caught up in this. But to do that, you have to do it full on. I mean, perfect 100%, otherwise it doesn't work. If you actually say, oh, this is purity, you're still measuring. It's still a sign. It can confuse the hell out of you. Which is why that, you know, you shouldn't really do that unless you've got, you know, a few jhanas under your belt and know how to be still and let things go. Especially if you get pretty deep in your meditation. And that, even in not so deep in the meditation, it can still be a very useful technique. So stop measuring all these things. Stop measuring how far you've got in meditation or how far you haven't got in meditation. And that means you can't control. Which means you have to let go. Which means you become still. Which means everything disappears. You've got nothing to do anymore. Yeah. Who was it? You were. Relativity, yeah, sure, duality, signs. That's why that when I first mentioned, I remember mentioning that in Thailand, when they asked me to give a talk, a And they said, Ajahn Brahma is just giving his third Zen Patriarch talk. The path is easy for one without preferences. One without judging. It's fascinating, but don't try that as a philosophy. You get sort of in that's right, yeah. Because, you know, you have to measure in life. Please, when you're making your husband's dinner tonight, please measure the right amount of this and the right amount of that. Otherwise, if you just don't measure it, you'll make a mess of the dinner. But when it gets to meditation, yeah, that's a powerful technique. Okay. Yeah, well, no, measuring is not synonymous, but it's a cause of doing. It's where it comes from. When you see that the path is dirty, you measure it, you've got to sweep it, or you've got to do something about it. When you see that you're imperfect, you measure you're imperfect, you've got to somehow get your act together and be better. How many conditions are there for the persistence of the silence, the difference of mind? There are three conditions for the persistence of the silence, the difference of mind. In other words, how you remain. Non-attention to all signs, attention to the signless element, and a prior determination of its duration. These are the three conditions. So, okay, we always said this is how you attain it, but it's persistence. And you've heard me say this before, the programming of your mindfulness, before you enter these states, it's silence. You've got no way to get in or get out. So you make that determination before. Now, I'll enter these deep meditations for half an hour, for an hour, for 2 hours. You make that resolution first of all, and it works. That's how you come out. So when you hear me say that, if you're in a deep meditation, you don't have to worry that you're going to miss an appointment. You tell yourself, determine, I will attain this deep state of meditation for 1 hour, and I'll come out in 1 hour's time. And you come out within a minute either side. And you don't need to do that with these deep meditations. Even your ordinary meditation, you'll be surprised. You know, you're not really getting deep. You just tell yourself, oh, this afternoon, and I must get out for 1 hour to see the news, or my favorite movie is coming on in 45 minutes and 30 seconds time. You can sit down there, close your eyes, say 45 minutes, 30 seconds, I'll come out of my meditation. It actually works for prior determination. How many conditions are there for the emergence from these deliverances of mind? There are two conditions for the emergence of this signless deliverance of mind: attention to all signs and non-attention to the signless element. In other words, the opposite of what gets you in here. As you emerge, if you continue to stop measuring, you'll just go back inside. So you've got to start measuring, start being attentive to things, and then you'll come out. The immeasurable deliverance of mind, the deliverance of mind through nothingness, the deliverance of mind through voidness, the deliverance of mind, the silence deliverance of mind, are these states different in meaning and different in name, or are they one in meaning and different only in name? Friend, the immeasurable deliverance of mind, the deliverance of mind through nothingness, the deliverance of mind through voidness, the silence deliverance of mind, there is a way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name, and there is a way in which they are one in meaning and different only in name. So it's a yes or no. What, friend, is the way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name? Here a monk, nun, layperson abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second, the third, the fourth, so above, below, around, everywhere, and to all as to himself, abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He does the same with a mind imbued with compassion, he does the same with a mind imbued with appreciative joy, and he does the same with equanimity. These are called the immeasurable deliverances of mind through the four Brahma Viharas. They are called immeasurable deliverances of mind. One of the reasons I would say with metta, you don't judge people. You just, the door of my heart is open to you no matter who you are. Non-judging, no signs. So this is the other forms of meditation which sometimes you have heard about. Standard, the four immaterial attainments, so not the four immeasurables through the four Brahma Viharas. And what is the deliverance of mind through nothingness? Here, with the complete samadhi at the base of infinite consciousness, aware there is nothing, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of nothingness. This is called the deliverance of mind through nothingness. That's at a rupa state. and aware. The point is here, aware there is nothing. So the awareness is there, the perception there, the feeling, the consciousness of nothingness. And that is that particular deliverance of mind. It's not enlightenment yet, it's the third arupa state. And what is the deliverance of mind through voidness? Again, this is the emptiness which we mentioned earlier. Voidness is sunyata. Here, a monk, nun, layperson, meditator, going to the forest, the root of a tree, to an empty heart, reflects thus. This is empty of a self, or empty of what belongs to a self. It is called deliverance of mind through emptiness. So in other words, you empty the mind of everything which... First of all, emptying the mind of the forest, emptying it of all your family, your friends, emptying it of the past and future, emptying it of thinking, emptying it of the body, until eventually you empty it of a me and a mine. So there's nothing absolutely left. That's the deliverance of mind through voidness. Now that is a nibbana state. Now what is the signless deliverance of mind? Here, with non-attention to all signs, a monk, nun, lay meditator enters upon and abides in the silence concentration of mind. I just mentioned that. This is called the silence deliverance of mind. This is the way in which these states are different in meaning, different in name. Different in meaning, sometimes they refer to totally different states, and also they've got different names. And what, friend, is the way in which these states are one in meaning and different only in name? And it's actually just because what you have to abandon to get into these states, all of them. They say lust or desire. Lust is just usually meant to be sexual lust, and it's, the word is much wider than that. It's just desire. It's a maker of measurement. Hate is a maker of measurement. Delusion is a maker of measurement. That's a wonderful saying. When you want something, then you start to measure things. When you sort of hate something, you measure them. They're hopeless. They're stupid. They're fat. They're ugly. You're measuring. And delusion is measuring. Look, you can't measure anybody. I've had a hard time in my life trying to find out, you know, who I am to measure me. Good, bad, wise, stupid. So you just forget measuring. So desire, hate or ill will, delusion is a maker of measurement. In someone whose arsenal's outflows are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off of the root, made like a palm stump, done away with, so they're no longer subject to future rising. So when an arahat, this lust, this ill will, or this desire, ill will, delusion, are cut off at the root. A palm stump, once you cut the head off a palm tree, it can't grow anymore, so it's dead. Finished, you can't revive it. So these things, it's not just they're abandoned, they can come up afterwards. It answers the question which people said afterwards, can a person, once they're enlightened, become unenlightened afterwards? You know, so once you're enlightened, an arahat, can you sort of revert back? So no, these are done, finished with, cut off at the root, like a palm tree, can't arise again. That's why the Buddha said it many times. So of all the kinds of immeasurable deliverance of mind, so of each of these different deliverance of mind, first of all, the immeasurable deliverance of mind, the unshakable deliverance of mind, which is for the arahat, is pronounced the best. Now, unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, void of delusion. So that's why they're saying that the best of each one of these things is when they go all the way to enlightenment. That's where they're one in meaning and one in name. Okay, now that's measuring. Desire is something, ill will is something, delusion is something. In a monk, nun, layperson whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off the root, made like a palm stump, done away with so they're no longer subject to future rising. Of all the kinds of deliverance of mind through no thing, the unshakable deliverance of mind, where there is no lust, no desire, no ill will or delusion, there's none of that left, that deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. The unshakable deliverance of mind is void of those three things. Lust or desire is a maker of signs, hate is a maker of signs, delusion is a maker of signs. In a monk, nun, lay person who's enlightened, whose taints are destroyed, These three things are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with, so they are no longer subject to future arising. Of all the kinds of signless deliverance of mind, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. But the unshakable deliverance of mind is void, is empty. Is empty of greed, hatred, and delusion. This is the way in which these states are one in meaning and different only in name. So you take each of those deliverances and take them to their peak of the enlightened person, and then you can actually see that they really are the same in meaning and in name, and different only in name. That is what Venerable Sāri Buddha said. Venerable Mahakotata was satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sāri Buddha's words. Now, if you've understood half of that, you've done pretty well. Because that's a very, very deep discourse. It's one of the reasons why the monks have avoided teaching it. But why not give it a try and expound it here? Because that was a discussion between two great experienced arahats. So that's the sort of stuff they discuss. Very powerful, very deep. But hopefully you got a lot of meaning out of that, at least something. Yes, you've got your hand up first, Nicholas. Yeah? Sorry, no, I think. So, deliverance of wisdom, deliverance of one mind. Oh, the arupa. It's. No, I think all enlightened have deliverance of mind, deliverance of wisdom. But the difference is actually seen in the Kitagiri Sutta. What number is that? 60 something. Where they ask what the difference is. See if I can find it. That's Kitagiri. 70, okay. Kitagiri Sutta. Return to number 70 if you've got it in front of you. Okay, Kitagiri, okay. Okay. It's paragraph 14 again. Here we go. The seven types of people. The first two. One liberated in both ways, one liberated by wisdom. But even one liberated by wisdom, they're still liberated by mind as well. Liberated by both ways means something different. But what is the difference here? One liberated both ways, one liberated by wisdom. Those are the two types of arahats. One liberated in both ways, some person has experience of the immaterial attainments. That person is called one liberated in both ways. One liberated by wisdom, here some person does not have experience of the immaterial attainments, but the attainments are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. This person is called liberated by wisdom. They still consider to be liberated by mind as well, because they still have the jhanas. The only difference is whether they have the immaterial attainments or not. Is that okay? Yes. That's right, yes, yeah. That's right, yes. And that particular one, 27, yes. So, the deliverance, the signless deliverance of mind, that is an attainment of, that would be an attainment, signless deliverance of mind, it would be a cessation of the mind. It would actually lead to that if it goes to the end. So that would be the same as the vital formations finishing. So that is in the sense of carrying on from the paragraphs 23 to 26, talking about the difference between someone dead and someone entering cessation. So as I understand, the signless deliverance of mind would lead to the cessation of perception of feeling. Immeasurable deliverance of mind, yes, that will carry you on. But remember, just as a method there, this is where you develop loving kindness, compassion, mudita, or upekkha, But you use words like that. You don't have to use those precise words, but you use those as an idea, as a one particular way to encourage the feeling of metta until it gets so strong it becomes nimitta and takes you into the jhana and off you go. So that's the measureless deliverances of mind using the Brahma Viharas. You know, you start by having a verbal commentary to your meditation, but the verbal commentary is there to arouse the feeling of metta, the feeling of mudita, the feeling of karuna, the feeling, the experience of equanimity until it gets so strong it takes off by itself and you don't need to say any words anymore. It is. This is something the commentaries keep on saying, that if you do the metta Brahma Vihara, the first of these, it'll only take you to first. Perception of nothingness. This is actually very clearly stated in the... This is from the Potapada Sutra I was just looking at a couple of weeks ago. When I gave a talk to the monks, that the path of deep meditation is refining your perception, taking one perception, letting it disappear to get an even more refined perception. And so this is what you're perceiving, this is what you're knowing. If you emerge from a state of this third arupa and you are asked to describe it, you say, what are you aware of? There's nothing there, absolutely nothing. Nothing there. Then you ask, how do you know there was nothing? Oh, I was aware there was nothing. So there was something there. Well, but I was aware, but there was nothing. That's why that if ever you attain any of these states, and if ever you come out afterwards, you just, gee, what the hell was that? How can I describe it? And if you have an experience and you start reading this sort of stuff, you think, my goodness, not only the Buddha was there, but he knew how to describe these states. You go into really, really weird states, which is just so hard to describe. And the Buddha was not just a great, had great experience. He just knew how to describe these things with such beautiful similes. And that's something which is very, very impressive. His teaching ability. Here's the fourth jhana, yes. Quite likely, if you really... It's a subset of these other things. So in order to... Yeah. I think one of the reasons you can only conjecture why it is there and why other things are missing, why you only said the first jhana, no mention the second, third jhana, why you mentioned a couple of the arupa states, it would probably be because, you know, just that some of the monks, the most likely explanation is some of the monks were asking questions about these particular things. So Mahakotita would have his own set of disciples. He would probably know the answers, but in order to give those answers more authority, he would take all his disciples to see Sariputta, ask these questions for the benefit of his disciples. So these would be probably the questions which his disciples were asking him. So this is not considered to be, none of the suttas are considered to be, okay, what's Buddhism? Let's give a talk on all the different deliverances. This will be specific to the people who were there at the time. So he would not be teaching Dhamma, he'd be teaching people. That's why the suttas are sometimes specific to the people around, to time and place, rather than something being abstract from the people listening. That means that sometimes if things are missing, sometimes things which you think should be there, which aren't there, simply because people never ask that question. But it also grounds it in people's experience, so it doesn't become just an abstract academic philosophy. We're talking about real people who would have been there, and these would have been their questions.
I have one more question. I'm going to leave you to continue that way.
Everybody, say. You may have a strong case that you have to be a stream winner in order to abide in such a powerful state. But there's no strong evidence there. Yeah. I would agree with you there personally. But there's no sort of foundation there in the suttas to say so. Obviously, the less you're going to let go a heap, and if you... You've got training of virtue, yes. I agree with you there, because the amount of letting go necessary to get into such a deep state, if you can let go so much, you haven't got much to let go of. You must have sort of let go of most of the things beforehand. You might get into... Go on, yes. I agree with you there. Okay, so yes, Lynn? A maker of signs, it makes distinctions. That's measures. So the difference between signs and measures is whenever I see a sign, it says like serpentine 10 miles. You see the direction, we also see a measure of how far it is. It's hard to see a sign without a measure. Okay, thank you for persisting. It was very long sutta, very deep sutta. And thank you for... at least listening to it, and don't worry too much if you understand very little of it. If you understand a fraction, it's amazing. So you want to sort of take every sutta here and present it, and just because of respect for you. Very good. Okay, so let's pray to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then we can go.